3, 2, 1. At Jim Sampson's campaign headquarters Sunday afternoon, a handful of supporters answer phones, blow up balloons, and plan who should be doing what during the last days before the election. Sampson's campaign was the best financed and was well planned. Plenty of commercials, flyers going out in the mail to registered voters regularly, and lots of big blue and white campaign signs touting Jim Sampson for borough mayor. Sampson feels good about his campaign because it's been a positive one. He's been running as the candidate who is outside the process and will bring a fresh voice to borough government.
I think the issues that I've seen in talking to people is, I think what they're looking for is a different tone that they've seen in the last few years. They want to see a movement, I believe, more toward solving problems and getting along with people.
Sampson says he can bring that different tone since he hasn't played a role in any of the past disputes between the mayor and the assembly. He has administrative experience as state labor commissioner under Governor Cooper and says if elected, he'll take a firm hold on the administration of borough government. The candidate with the most experience in local government is Harold Gillum, who was borough mayor 25 years ago and wants to do it again. Things were pretty quiet at Gillum's Second Avenue home Sunday. He was preparing to do some door-to-door campaigning in South Fairbanks. Gillum also feels good about his campaign.
There's 8 contenders there, but there's only one candidate, and that's myself.
Gillum takes credit for raising the issues he feels everyone else is now promoting: solid waste, recycling, economic development, and cooperation with the assembly. Overall, the mayoral campaign has been fairly positive. Sampson and Gillum have raised the most money and appear to be the front runners. They've also been portrayed as special interests, which both men deny.
Well, I think it's no doubt that Jim Sampson is a labor candidate. I'm not the ITA candidate. I have their endorsement, but I am not an ITA candidate.
Well, I certainly think the ITA candidate is, I agree with that perception, and I think a lot of people do. I don't perceive myself as a labor candidate. I certainly bring with me support from labor, and that's because I've worked with labor for many years. I also bring with me more business support.
Sampson and Gillum both say they have a broad base of support. Sampson says many business leaders are supporting him as the candidate who can bring people together. And Gillum says just because he's endorsed by the ITA doesn't mean he's in their pocket, and he's not. He says he has no control over the group, but also has no problem accepting its endorsement either.
I think the ITA has been a good thing. It's been a watchdog on the political bodies, and that's very desirable to have somebody watching their activities, because it's so easy to spend your money. And when ITA or somebody is watching over the expenses, we're a lot more careful. So I think that's beneficial. It keeps the people active, and it keeps a lot of interest in their local government.
The ITA has also chosen to single out Jim Sampson in the final days of the campaign. The organization has a 2-page advertisement in the Fairbanks Daily News Miner with endorsements and comments about borough and city candidates. But a separate ad is directed towards Sampson. Sampson sees that as unfair but not unexpected, and he says he won't use similar tactics. Sampson has had the opportunity to criticize his 6 opponents who currently serve on the assembly. Recently, the borough lost a tax cap case and a ruling over its building lease, both issues which directly involve the assembly. Sampson says he won't make an issue out of it, but he does have an opinion.
I try not to Monday night quarterback, but certainly people on the assembly need to be held accountable for their votes. You know that you have assembly people that are running. They talk about open meetings, but they have secret meetings. They talk about more communication, and they have confrontation. They have opportunities to settle and resolve legal issues like court litigation on the building, and they don't take the attorney's advice.
With 8 candidates in the race, a small percentage of the vote could win the election for any one of them. No runoff election will be held. The other assembly members who are running aren't as well financed, but also stress their experience and knowledge as assets. After 3 years, Bonnie Williams and Don Lowell are both giving up their assembly seats to try for the job. Paul Chismar has been on the Assembly for 10 years, Hank Bartos 2, and Bob Coghill was first elected last fall. Gillum, Chismar, Bartos, and Coghill will all remain on the Assembly if they lose in their bids for mayor. The other candidate in the race is Charles Kegler, a tax preparer who has never held public office. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. In Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton.
People who are elected are forced to look at all of the community and all of its interests, and not just at the interests of the district where they happen to live. This, I know, in terms of my experience in the school board, makes a considerable difference because we build schools in different parts of the district. If we had a need for a school just in North Pole, then the person selected from that area would strongly push the interest, but other people from different regions wouldn't necessarily favor building a school in North Pole. Now that we have an at-large system, means that each and every member of the board or each and every member of the borough assembly has to keep in mind what the total needs of the community are. And the decision-making body, the borough assembly or the school board, is supposed to act on behalf of the whole region and not just its particular districts. It's going to produce much more conflict and fighting between different geographic districts in the borough. It's probably going to make it more difficult to reach community-wide decisions, but the upside is that it's going to be representing people in their districts and communities better. They'll be able to see that they have a voice. It may cut campaign costs, but I wouldn't be optimistic about that. I think that people in a district system would still be forced to be doing some expensive media, especially if they're newcomers to politics. And on top of that, they would have to be canvassing the communities. That would be a much greater time commitment on their part. And so I think that then the possibilities for individuals who are strongly committed, for more vocal groups to be more represented than is the case presently.
Three, two, one. Less than a week after the borough assembly rejected a negotiated settlement, Judge Mary Green ruled that the borough did breach its lease. In an order signed Thursday, Green says the clear language of the lease agreement precluded the borough from acquiring or purchasing any substitute space for administration offices during the term of the lease. Dick Fisher sued the borough last year when the assembly bought the Fifth Avenue Center. They intend to move out of Fisher's building in 1994 when the borough says its lease is up. Judge Green ruled against Fisher on some other motions, but he did win a main liability point when she agreed the lease was breached. Fisher now can ask for monetary damages to the tune of $4 million when he goes to court next week. The borough assembly could still consider settling, but acting borough attorney Mark Andrews says last week's deal, which would have let the borough out of its lease in 1999, isn't on the table anymore.
No, it's not looking like he would consider the same settlement. The last settlement we heard from Mr. Fisher's attorney was to accept all three options in the future, which would in effect make it a 25-year term to the year 2009. Plus, they wanted attorney's fees on his costs.
Six borough assembly members voted against the settlement last week, saying they want a court to decide whether or not the lease was legal to begin with. They contend the clause which says the borough can't even look for other office space is illegal. That question wasn't answered by Green's preliminary ruling this week, and attorney Andrews says there is only a chance that it will be answered.
The issue's been raised, so I say the case could settle it if it went to an appeal. We are in a position to raise that on appeal. As things stand now, we can still move for reconsideration. And that's about it. There are other motions that could be made during the course of a trial, but there is still an appeal. The issue is present in the case. That's what I mean. Right now, it looks like it's been decided, although she didn't reach that issue expressly.
The trial to settle any damages Fisher is pursuing is set to start next Wednesday. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. In Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton. Three, two, one. Last year, the number of registered borough voters was close to 43,000, but borough clerk Mona Lisa Drexler says this year the number is down to 39,774.
The voter registration has traditionally stayed between 42,000 to drop from 42,817 to 39,774. I was surprised at that. However, the state purges the rolls. And if people have not voted in a local or state election for a couple of years, they purge their name off of the roll and they have to re-register to vote.
Voters will cast ballots for borough mayor, 3 borough assembly members, and 2 school board representatives. 3 Fairbanks City Council members will be elected by the 14,000 voters who live in the city of Fairbanks. Even with nearly 40,000 registered voters in the borough, less than half of them are likely to take the time to vote today. Drexler says turnout is one of those things that you can't project.
As a matter of fact, 3 years ago during the mayor race, that was a low voter turnout, 43.1%. And prior to that, we'd been averaging anywhere from 44 to 46, 47% of the voters. So it's been declining in the last few years, actually, the voter turnout.
Polls are open until 8 o'clock tonight, and Drexler says the polling places haven't changed, but if you have a question about where to cast your ballot, you can call the borough clerk's office or the State Division of Elections. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. 3, 2, 1. Since the Assembly rejected a settlement 2 weeks ago, 2 things have changed. The first is Judge Mary Green's ruling last week that the borough did violate its lease with Dick Fisher when it bought the Fifth Avenue Center. The second is Assembly members learned that they couldn't fight the case on the grounds they wanted to because a legal motion wasn't filed on time. So last night they voted 10-1 to accept a new settlement. Assemblymember Bonnie Williams was one of several assembly members who voted yes to settle this time.
It was made very clear to us by the attorneys that we had no choice. Circumstances had changed, and as a consequence of those changed circumstances, there was no point in going to court. We had to get a settlement.
Assembly members who voted against settling the last time did it because they believe the lease isn't legal. They wanted to go to court to defend violating the lease on those grounds. But Thursday night they learned they wouldn't get the chance to do that. Apparently the borough attorney failed to file a motion back in July, so Judge Green said she wouldn't consider that aspect of the case. Assemblymember Walt Johnson says that ended the borough's hopes.
We missed out on an opportunity because we didn't file a motion in a timely manner, and that is on constitutional grounds. I think we have pursued this item on constitutional grounds. We stood a very good chance of winning it. But because of the fact we did not file that motion in a timely manner, we were denied that is a way of pursuing this. And so consequently, the gist of our defense was taken away from us.
Johnson was the only one to vote against the settlement, though. He says he doesn't want to pay Fisher $95,000, a cash amount he'll get as part of the settlement. Along with the money, the settlement agreement calls for the borough to exercise its first 5-year option on the lease and stay in the building until 1999. But under this agreement, they also cannot move the borough administration offices to the Fifth Avenue Center until 2 years after the lease expires. That restriction means the borough will either have to renew its lease for the additional 2 years, move somewhere else, or buy the building. Assemblymember John Davies says that provision of the agreement was one thing Fisher wanted.
This is really his pound of flesh for winning the lawsuit. I mean, he won. Judge Green basically gave him the interpretation that he wanted, which effectively made it a 25-year lease. If you buy her theory, that was a 25-year lease. He could have let us out of it, but if he chose not to, we were in for 25 years.
Davies says buying the building may be one of the more realistic financial options by 1999. Assembly members discussed the deal during a closed-door session. They spent nearly 10 minutes debating whether or not it should be a private discussion, and then voted 8-3 to go into an executive session after attorneys told them it was the best way to get a full and frank discussion of where they stood. 2 attorneys spent nearly 2 hours meeting privately with the Assembly. Attorney Jim DeWitt of Guess and Rudd says under the circumstances, it's not a bad deal for the borough. And Attorney Michael McLaughlin says the settlement was in the best interests of both parties.
And there's risk to all parties. There was Mr. Fisher had risk, and the borough also had risk. And I think that the settlement that we see here is a product of both parties coming together and realizing that they both had risk.
If the borough had not agreed to settle, the trial was set to begin today. Fisher believed he was due some $4 million in damages from the borough for breaching its lease. A jury would have decided that. Now Fisher will get more than $4 million in rent through 1999. He's also getting $95,000 cash. Other costs to the borough may not be known until after the lease runs out. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. 3, 2, 1. The needs assessment involves two surveys. One was a phone survey of more than 300 households. The other went to community leaders and asked them to rate 66 human services. Surveys were conducted last spring, and United Way board members will get a look at the results later this month. That will help them decide on allocations for nonprofit agencies and organizations seeking United Way funding. Nora Kelly has been compiling the results of the 1991 needs assessment. She says they aren't really surprising and show many of the same problems people expressed 5 years ago. One of the top concerns remains family problems of violence, abuse, and neglect. And Kelly says those things may be underreported because people aren't as likely to admit them.
The most personal problems that people might experience, drug abuse, alcohol abuse, family violence, problems with children, they're less inclined over the telephone to tell you they have that problem, and that's natural and something to be expected in a survey. So if you went by the survey alone, you would think we did not have those problems in our community. I think sometimes less than 1% admitted to experiencing those problems.
Other critical concerns raised involve health issues, substance abuse, mental and emotional health, and children's behavioral problems. And things like teen pregnancy, prenatal, and infant care seem to be more prominent on the list this time. Economic and unemployment needs were also raised as key issues. Kelly says one interesting thing that the household survey showed is that people really don't seem to see problems in their own neighborhoods.
We suspect that there are a lot of social problems out there that people are blind to and aren't aware of. On the other hand, it's understandable in a community where over 45% of our respondents live in a house on 1 acre or more and may not, in fact, be aware of what's happening in their immediate neighborhood.
Another element of the survey was how to pay for the needs in the community. Kelly says that really is the heart of the matter here.
That's the real issue. What is the role of the local community in supporting social services? What's the role of the United Way? What's the role of the state? Who's to pick up the pieces when the funding cuts are made? Is taxation an appropriate method for local support? Are donations through the United Way the appropriate way to go? I think that's really the heart of it, and I don't think anybody has decided yet what's going to happen.
The survey does ask about a sales tax. Kelly says 55% of those surveyed were willing to pay more to meet the needs, and the majority of them said they would support a sales tax. But she also notes that the question came up near the end of the survey, when people may have been more sympathetic to the needs that were raised. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. In Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton. Three, two, one. The mayors of Fairbanks, North Pole, and the North Star Borough sat down with DEC Deputy Commissioner Meade Treadwell Wednesday morning. They all put their signatures on an environmental agreement. It outlines what all four entities will do to address public health issues important to the communities. Things like city sludge disposal, air quality, and the borough landfill are among the 8 things that the communities have agreed to address. DEC's Meade Treadwell says instead of DEC telling the communities what to do, the idea here is to come up with a common agenda.
The state has never really sat down with communities on a community-by-community basis and said, what are your priorities? And what we've got here is a commitment to address these priorities together. The solid waste problem is something that is a big one. It's going to be an expensive one for the borough to tackle, and some long-term decisions need to be made. The sludge problem we've been working on, and we should be looking at, and we are interested in looking at other innovative technologies if there are technologies available. The issue of contaminated sites in Fairbanks is a big one. It's our hope that we can basically get rid of the contaminated sites in Alaska by the year 2000. The department has a 10-year plan, and we think we have the funding to be able to do that. It's amazing and astounding to me to learn that we the federal government and private industry will probably be spending over $50 million a year in the state of Alaska for the foreseeable future to get rid of contaminated waste, and quite a bit of that is here in Fairbanks.
And the mayors are glad to work with DEC on this list, since occasionally the agency has been viewed as an adversary. Fairbanks Mayor Wayne Nelson says it goes a long way toward solving the us versus them problem.
This says this is our problem, not your problem. And that means that we will work together on it. And I think there's a commitment on all of our parts to do that.
And simply working out the details of the agreement improved things. Borough Mayor Juanita Helm says it shows everyone wants to work toward the same goals.
Until everybody gets together and talks, you don't know how one solution may negatively affect somebody else. And just the dialogue of constructing this document makes it a better working relationship among us.
The agreement is a checklist to identify problems with a time frame toward solving them. For example, the DEC plans to assist the borough in writing a solid waste management plan and will help with site selection for a new landfill. They also promise to help the city evaluate sludge disposal options. And they'll help with the borough's emergency plan to handle hazardous substance spills. The DEC also promises to help figure out what to do with waste oil, how to protect groundwater, and how to clean up leaking underground storage tanks. There aren't any enforcement mechanisms set up in the agreement, though, but Mead Treadwell says the first step toward solving the problems is just to agree to work together on them.
When it comes to the environment, they say, well, environmental regulators need to be more enforcement-oriented. Well, I'm not going to put any one of these three mayors in jail if they can't deal with their garbage problem or their sludge problem. We work for the same people. We're saying we're not going to make all the decisions for a community. We need to make them together.
The agreement will be reviewed twice a year by the communities in the state. They hope to keep it flexible to address environmental issues as they change over the years. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. 3, 2, 1. When Borough Mayor Juanita Helms decided to step down after 6 years on the job, it opened the field for 8 candidates. 6 of them are currently on the Borough Assembly, a group that has been at odds with the mayor several times in the last few years. So a main issue in the campaign this fall has been peace, and each candidate claims to be the one who can bring about a cooperative new spirit in borough government. A main contender in the race is Harold Gillum, a longtime Fairbanks resident who was borough mayor back in the 1960s, city mayor in the 70s, and is currently on the Borough Assembly. On experience alone, Gillum claims to be the best candidate for the job.
I've said several times that there's 8 contenders there, but there's only one candidate, and that's myself.
Gillum is also endorsed by the Interior Taxpayers Association, a group formed a few years ago to fight tax increases by successfully putting a tax cap on the ballot. A vote to continue that tax cap is on borough ballots again this election. The ITA is promoting that, along with Gillum, but the group has also taken a strong stand against a man they apparently see as Gillum's main competition, former State Labor Commissioner Jim Sampson. As one of 2 candidates who is not a part of local government now, Sampson has run his well-financed campaign as the political outsider who can bring everyone together because he has not been part of the problem.
I haven't been involved in the fray, the confrontation, the disputes between the assembly and the mayor, and the individual assembly members have been. So it seems to me that I bring with me no axes, no baggage, you know, as it relates to disputes between the assembly. So I think I would be able to work with them. It would be a clean, we'd start fresh.
Even though Gillum and Sampson have raised the most money in the race for mayor, 6 others think they have a shot at the job, too. Bonnie Williams and Don Lowell decided not to seek re-election to the assembly and run for mayor instead. Assembly members Hank Bartos, Paul Chismar, and Bob Coghill also want the job. The final candidate in the race is Charles Kegler. 3 borough assembly seats are also on the ballot. Only 1 incumbent is running, so at least 2 new assembly members will be elected. 2 school board members will also be chosen by voters. And the city of Fairbanks residents cast ballots for 3 city council members, including 1 to fill out the term of Bill Wally, who died of a heart attack in July. The city's financial problems and the loss of city services that has resulted from those problems have been main issues in those campaigns. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton. 3, 2, 1. An 8-way race proved to be no contest at all. Jim Sampson walked away with 46% of the vote in his first bid for elected office. Sampson beat several other more conservative candidates, Newly elected borough assembly members are also less conservative than their opponents. Sampson sees that as a sign that the community wants a change in tone.
I think the message is being sent very clear to the extremes on the assembly, and that is we want you to come a little bit more toward the center, perhaps compromise a little bit, perhaps let's start working together on our community problems and not be worried so much about your individual agendas. I think the people sent a clear message is let's get down to business and do the public's business.
Sampson ran as the candidate who was outside the process. His closest challenger was Harold Gillum. 32% of the voters supported Gillum. None of the other six candidates earned even 10% of the vote. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornson. 3, 2, 1. Running as a person who wasn't part of the problem, Jim Sampson assured himself of a role in borough government for the next 3 years. Sampson says his margin of victory was a surprise, but he believes his election sends a message.
I think the community was looking for somebody that perhaps would provide a different perspective, somebody that was new. I happened to be new. And I think it certainly sent a message to those in Fairbanks politics who have tried to use last-minute type campaigns to win. And I think the last few days we stayed on course. We ran a positive campaign. There's certainly in our minds some large numbers of undecided voters, and I think at the last they swung to us, and perhaps that was our last effort in the end.
Sampson was supported by labor groups, but also earned his share of business support. His closest challenger was Harold Gillum, who finished with 32% of the vote. Gillum was endorsed by the Interior Taxpayers Association, which targeted Sampson in the final days of the campaign. But Gillum says the ITA support isn't what cost him the election.
I'm not going to blame ITA for my loss. It was my loss.
Gillum says he expects Sampson to maintain the status quo in borough government. Sampson says he'll appoint a transition team and plans to work with Mayor Juanita Helms as he prepares to take over the borough administration. Other winners in Tuesday's election were Hank Hove, Lane St. John, and Cheryl Kilgore in their bids for borough assembly. The borough tax cap was endorsed by 62% of the people in an advisory vote. Turnout in the election Tuesday was a little more than 38%. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornson. In Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornson. 3, 2, 1. When he walked into the borough administration building at about 11:15 Tuesday night, Jim Sampson's supporters were well ahead of him. Sampson's campaign efforts not only brought him a victory, but earned him 46% of the vote. His closest challenger was Harold Gillum, who was more than 2,000 votes behind him. Everyone was surprised by the margin of victory, including Sampson.
We thought we ran a good campaign, a good positive campaign, and we certainly had no idea at all that it would be, we would receive this kind of support. So I have to say I was as surprised as anybody.
Even more surprising was the showing of the other candidates. Between them, Sampson and Gillum got 78% of the vote. A distant third was Bonnie Williams, with 8%. Williams says she didn't think anyone would get over 30% of the vote.
It shows you the power of advertising, doesn't it?
Is there anything you would have done differently or could have done differently?
No, if you don't have the money, obviously you can't do it.
Hank Bartos also saw money as making the difference in his unsuccessful campaign. His optimism about the race diminished a few weeks ago.
I received a setback. I thought there was a group in town that was going to be supporting me, and they didn't. And that my campaign was kind of planned around that. And then when that didn't come to pass, it let a lot of the air out of the campaign. But we still progressed, you know, and hoping that the voters of the community would still support us, but we didn't have the money that we needed to really compete with some of the big money people, and without the money it's tough to run a campaign.
Money wasn't a problem for Sampson, who was well financed, but Sampson says that wasn't the reason he won.
If you go back and look at when Mayor Helms ran and when Bill Allen ran, they both, I believe, spent more money than I spent, and I didn't have the name recognition the other candidates had. When I first started, I had 36% name recognition, and some of the others had as high as 90, and a couple were 78 and 80. So, no, I think it's hard work. You know, we worked real hard, and I think that I think the community saw that we worked real hard, and I think they responded by giving us their vote. And when you're not on the assembly, you have to get your name out there, and we did it the best way we can.
The man with a lot of name recognition is dealing with defeat today. Harold Gillum expected to win. With Sampson in the mayor's office, Gillum says communication between the mayor and the assembly will get better, but policies won't change much.
I think we will have very much the status quo. Many of the directors of the various departments will remain. And I don't think we will see any change.
One thing that will change, though, is the makeup of the assembly.
There's probably a new era dawning here. The assembly has definitely taken a less conservative twist.
Assemblymember Hank Hove, who easily won re-election with nearly 64% of the vote, Hove says with Lane St. John and Cheryl Kilgore elected to the assembly and Jim Sampson in the mayor's office, it's going to be a whole new ball game. St. John's race with Marlene Leake was one of the closest, with less than 500 votes separating the two. St. John says he knew it was going to be close.
Marlene's had two other tries at this. She's got more experience than I did, so I was the new kid on the block and very nervous and had to learn a lot and did learn a lot. I'm sure I've got a lot more to learn.
St. John and Kilgore replaced Bonnie Williams and Don Lowell as assembly members. Also on the ballot was an advisory vote on renewing the borough tax cap. 62% of the voters said yes to that idea, and 85% of the voters say they want to continue electing assembly members at large. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. 3-2-1. By ordinance, the City Council gives 70% of the money from the bed tax to the Fairbanks Convention and Visitors Bureau and another percentage to the Fairbanks Industrial Development Corporation. The 1989 initiative, sponsored by the ITA, would have made that money available for things besides tourist and entertainment activities, in effect freeing up the $1 million in bed tax revenues for other things. The Supreme Court says that initiative does not reduce the council's control over the appropriations process. City Attorney Herb Kuss says the court agreed with the city's position that it would broaden the council's authority to appropriate bed tax funds.
When you look at the purpose behind the prohibitions against allowing initiatives to be used to interfere with a governing body's flexibility, this initiative, in fact, tried to what the court called undedicate funds rather than dedicate funds, and to give the council more flexibility over the bed tax funds, so that now, rather than setting aside a certain amount of money to be spent for certain designated organizations, the council now would be at total liberty to, in its discretion, designate the funds to any applicant for those funds who, in the process of seeking grants, will seek certain funds for as broad a purpose as promoting economic development, and that could virtually encounter any nonprofit organization in the city of Fairbanks.
The Superior Court ruling took the initiative off the ballot in 1989. As a result of the Supreme Court ruling, the initiative should be placed back on the ballot. By law, that means it must go to the voters within 60 days. But City Attorney Herb Kuss says the City Council may be able to alleviate the cost of a special election if it passes an ordinance that accomplishes the same thing that the initiative would have. Such an ordinance is being drafted. But even if it passes, the change doesn't mean there will be change. Who says it would still leave the decision in the hands of the City Council.
The Bureau and the Fairbanks Industrial Development Corporation would have to submit their proposals and compete on an equal footing with other organizations. Everyone should be aware, of course, that the Council may continue to fund the Bureau as it has in prior years. Ironically, the current ordinance, which the initiative seeks to change, the Council had that same flexibility also. It did not automatically have to fund the Bureau at 70%. So in some ways, the initiative does not change a lot in substance, but it does change the process through which people may compete for bed tax funds on an equal footing with the Bureau and the Fairbanks Industrial Development Corporation.
Fairbanks City Attorney Herb Koos. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. In Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton. Here's the host intro. Just what higher education in Alaska is doing for Native students was the topic of a workshop Wednesday. The Alaska Federation of Natives turned its attention to the next 20 years and what role Alaska Natives will play in higher education. And they say there is plenty of room for improvement. Ann Thornton reports. Story coming in 3, 2, 1. One thing higher education officials and Native leaders agree on is that education will be even more important in the future. But Alaska Natives want to improve the product they're getting now. During a panel discussion on higher education, University of Alaska President Jerome Commissar told AFN members that the university recognizes its responsibilities to Alaska Natives and will meet them. But former Board of Regents member Sam Keto wasn't so sure. He called his 8 years on the Board of Regents frustrating, saying the University of Alaska did little to respond to the needs of Alaska Natives and is no more responsive today. And Keto isn't sure about the future.
What I see is a desire to want to see things change. But what is going to change if the answer to the change is developing an academic institution that takes away from the Alaska Natives' culture in order to have a success?
Keto's main complaint is that the university won't take risks. He points to UAF's Rural Alaska Honors Institute as a program that has made a difference for Native students, but says that idea started with Native leaders in the legislature, not the university. He says there are other new things that the university should try.
Go out and hire somebody that has some new ideas, that's not going to just sit back and receive his check and say, well, gee, we had another good year, but what did we do? Nothing very significantly new. Tutoring programs, outreach programs, programs that bring the faculty closer to the students, programs that bring employees on the campus closer to the students, and programs that bring the community closer to the students from the rural areas of the state. Those are the kind of risk-taking that you have in order for students to really feel part of the system. We have a new president. We'll see what kind of risk-taker he is.
UA President Jerome Commissar did a lot of listening during the afternoon workshop, and he believes things are changing, even if it's happening slowly.
What Sam Keto was saying is that universities, like many other large organizations, are slow to adapt new methods and slow to abandon methods that might not have worked as well as people had hoped. What he's asking for is a creative response to major social needs. I think the university is attempting to do that. I think if you go through and talk to many of the faculty involved with rural education, that they have been creating new programs, they've been creating new courses, they've been experimenting with new electronic technology in order to improve the educational system. We've been looking at unique ways of developing bridging programs so that the transfer from high school to college becomes easier. And what he was asking for, I think we're in the process of providing.
Natives also see the need to integrate into the higher education system. Sam Keto says assimilation works, but the trade-off is that Natives lose part of their culture. If they integrate instead, they can make their culture part of the system. And another option may be considered. There's more talk now about a tribal college in Alaska, similar to those in the lower 48. There, Native culture is preserved while a higher education degree is pursued. If that is studied, it could be developed within the university system or outside of it. Commissar says it would gain a great deal if it were within the system, and it's something he's interested in learning more about.
The University of Alaska, I would estimate, educates about 90%, most probably more than 90% of the Native Alaskans that are studying in the state of Alaska. I don't expect that figure to change. What I hope takes place is that there are more Native Alaskan students attending institutions of higher education, and one of them might very well be a tribal college that provides unique and very important services.
Alaska Natives involved in the workshop noted that AFN may not be in the education business, but some think it should be. They'd like the Federation to take a more active role and push for more rural student services. They also say the university's concerns about a tight budget is no excuse, and Native leaders should push the university to reallocate money toward programs that help Native students. For KUAC News in Anchorage, I'm Ann Thornton. In Anchorage, I'm Ann Thornton.
Okay, here is the lead. Like any other group, Alaska Natives may not always agree on all the issues, but when it comes to subsistence, they all agree it's a way of life, and most Natives will speak out to protect it. As Nellie Moore reports, as the Alaska Federation of Natives gets ready to celebrate the 20th anniversary of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, the subsistence issue is just as hot as it was back in the 70s. Okay, in 3, 2, 1.
Are we willing to give our guests subsistence when our elders tell us that subsistence is not food? Subsistence is who we are? I say no. We can't afford to let that go, for that is us.
District 24 Representative Georgiana Lincoln of Rampart summed up the sentiments of many of the Natives who spoke here Wednesday. Her comments came one day after Governor Walter Hickel met with Native leaders in a closed-door session. At the meeting, Hickel said he would withdraw his subsistence proposal made public last month and go back to the drawing table. Mitch Dementiff of Nenana is a member of Hickel Subsistence Advisory Commission. He says the meeting with Hickel opened significant opportunities for Natives.
Basically, the governor yesterday announced at the AFN board meeting that he's going to expand the agenda to include the possible consideration of a constitutional amendment, and also to invite AFN to participate in the process.
Sea Alaska shareholder Bill Thomas is a member of the Southeast Alaska Subsistence Commission, organized under ANILCA. He says, based on Native opposition to the subsistence proposal, Hickel made the right move.
Well, I wasn't surprised because it generated absolutely no support, and so the better part of valor was a discretion like that. So I thought that was a good move. It wasn't even a good political move. It was just a good move.
Mackay Campbell, Hickel's special assistant on subsistence and the man credited with drawing up the proposal, says the closed-door meeting was a chance for Natives to see how committed Hickel is to solving the subsistence dilemma.
People got to talk to the governor personally, and when you've dealt with somebody personally, it's harder than to think all these terrible things about them that people may have heard. You know, I think they got the chance to see that he is a man of good faith, that he is a man that is totally committed to getting this resolved and to protecting subsistence, and I think that's good.
Campbell spoke at the workshop Wednesday, asking Natives to help the state come up with a better subsistence plan. You are all the experts on subsistence, he told the packed meeting room. He says the administration is not happy with the criteria set out in the plan, but they were not able to come up with anything better. At the same time, he says he doesn't think there are enough votes in the Alaska legislature to go for a constitutional amendment that would satisfy ANILCA and bring state management of fish and game back to federal lands in Alaska. Representative Lincoln disagrees. She says most legislators are open to Native issues and can be convinced a constitutional amendment is needed, but it will take a lot of work.
I think that we have our work cut out for us to do those things that I say is the negotiation, the consultation, in addition to the task force members, in addition to AFN, in addition to our elders throughout the state, our youth throughout the state. It's going to take a whole concerted effort to see that as a reality, but it's there. We just have to get that wheel more squeaky.
AFN President Julie Kitka says the organization is pushing for congressional oversight hearings on the subsistence provisions in ANILCA and how they've been implemented since the Alaska Supreme Court struck down a state subsistence law, and how state management of fish and game on state and private lands may affect federal management on federal lands. Kitka says so far she has had favorable reaction from many congressmen on holding the oversight hearings. At the workshop Wednesday, some natives expressed exasperation over having the whole issue raised over and over again. But Mitch Dementev says it's important enough he hopes natives will be fighting over the issue for years to come.
I don't believe we're ever going to stop having to be concerned about maintaining our lifestyle. We native people have always had two primary concerns, the land and our subsistence. They were on the first agendas of the first conventions that I ever went to as a young teenager, and they're still here now, and I'll bet you that my kids and my grandkids are going to be arguing about this 30 and 40 years down the line. In fact, I'd have to tell you very honestly that I'd be disappointed if they weren't. It's that important to us as Native people.
Reporting for KUAC News, I'm Nellie Moore in Anchorage.
Three, two, one. After a three-year absence, Native leaders from Alaska's interior brought a strong, unified presence to last week's Alaska Federation of Natives Convention. Resolutions dealing with hostile corporate takeovers and subsistence generated the most interest at AFN this year. During the three-day meeting in Anchorage, Alaska Natives from the interior played a leading role in the subsistence debate. Nenana's Mitch Dementev was the first delegate to address the resolution that calls for AFN to work with Governor Hickel to achieve a new subsistence plan that protects Native rights. Dementev is part of the Governor's Subsistence Advisory Group and says he's through giving up Native rights through compromise.
I gave all I have of my Native identity when we accepted the Claims Act of 71, when we accepted ANILCA in 1980. I have nothing left to give. As we proceed on with this next phase that AFN has agreed to do, and as I've been participating, watching out for the concerns of the Native people on the Governor's Subsistence Advisory Council, I have nothing left to give, and I intend to give no more.
Dementev was followed to the microphone by Tanana Chiefs Conference President Will Mayo. Mayo favors keeping management of fish and game on federal lands in federal control if no state solution is found.
We must amend to make it very clear that we will, in fact, not take any more steps backward. We have given enough, and I respectfully submit, make a motion that this amendment be included in the resolution.
AFN delegates approved that amendment, along with another that supports federal management of fish and game on all lands in Alaska if the state can't come up with a solution to the urban versus rural division over subsistence hunting and fishing. After overwhelming approval of the resolution, Mitch Dementev said it shows the Native community is again experiencing good relationships with the federal government, but maybe losing a little confidence in the state. But like Governor Hickel, Dementev is optimistic that something can be accomplished at the state level. He's looking forward to a new round of meetings on the issue. Dementev even sees the possibility that the governor will change his mind about his resistance to trying to amend the Constitution to include a rural preference for subsistence rights.
I'm not just completely convinced that he won't just say, well, I've got to get this thing behind me. He has an aggressive agenda for the state. So in order to get on with his agenda, he's got to solve these big problems. Now he's got another Exxon settlement, I wouldn't rule out him just saying, well, it's time to get this behind us. Let's put it to a vote of the people. You know, I'm not completely convinced that he won't do that.
And Dementev says if the governor does get behind a constitutional amendment, he has the ability to deliver the votes in the State House that kept that from being approved by the legislature in 1990. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. In Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton.
3, 2, 1. Board of Game Chairman Doug Pope says it's a loaded meeting. Wolf and brown bear hunting, along with a few subsistence issues, are among the agenda items. Pope says the issue he's heard the most about involves the Pack Creek Bear Sanctuary in southeast Alaska.
There's a proposal before the board to open up part of the sanctuary to brown bear hunting. and which has received a lot of comment from people in Southeast Alaska. There's a lot of people that don't like the proposal, some people that do. A lot of people think that the sanctuary should be expanded. There's just a lot of controversy coming out of Southeast Alaska on that.
The first issue the board takes up is the department's wolf management plan. Board members spent Wednesday afternoon and Thursday meeting with the wolf planning team that prepared wolf management recommendations. The department's plan to control wolf populations by zones is up for public comment today and over the weekend. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton. 3, 2, 1. The game board spent the last 2 days talking about wolves. A wolf management planning team last spring recommended a state wolf control plan after 6 months of meetings and discussions. The Department of Fish and Game developed a proposal based on those recommendations. Board of Game Chairman Doug Pope says he wanted to meet with the planning team and the department to find out where everyone stands on the strategic wolf management plan before the meeting starts.
I want the board to be educated about this and not be trying to come up to speed on the proposal while we're taking public comment. We're going to have 3 days of public comment on wolves and on bears, and I suspect that it will probably fill all 3 days, and I wanted the board to just be fully knowledgeable about this strategic management plan before we started taking comment.
Pope says the 7-member board will adopt, amend, or reject the wolf management plan and then go on to specific proposals. Those proposals include liberalizing bag limits on wolves to permitting aerial wolf hunting in some cases.
One of the questions that's raised by all of this is, should the Board of Game permit the department to engage in predator management on its own as it did in the past? That's one of the possibilities from this. I have no idea how it's going to turn out. It's way too early in the process.
The practice of hunting wolves from the air has been a controversial one in the past, and it's clearly one that the wolf management planning team wasn't in agreement on. Fish and Game Deputy Director of Wildlife Conservation Wayne Reglin was part of the planning team. Reglin says the department is recommending aerial hunting, if necessary, to meet population goals for wolves and for moose or caribou.
We haven't done any wolf control in Alaska since 1986. Land and shoot practices where people can, with just a hunting license, can land beside a wolf and shoot it, that will stop under our recommendations. That will become part of a wolf management plan and a wolf control or a wolf regulation plan, and it will be very limited to where it's necessary and where it's effective. And there might be areas, right now we might not have any, but in the future there might be areas where the department would go in because of low populations of moose or caribou and shoot wolves themselves.
Reglin says he expects that to be the most controversial aspect of the proposal, since it comes down to whether or not to shoot wolves to reduce populations and who should do it. Valerie Brown, an Anchorage environmentalist on the planning team, says if the board doesn't make significant changes in the plan, she'd like to see it rejected. She doesn't like the emergency situation plan the department has proposed that allows the department to initiate a wolf control plan if an unforeseen situation develops. And Brown doesn't agree with the department's definitions.
They've basically redefined what we've always traditionally called wolf control into two new words, and so now they're calling it wolf population regulation and wolf population reduction. And, periodically we get redefinitions of what we've been doing to wolves, and it's the same thing, but it's a new word. We had aerial trapping prior to 1988, which is exactly the same thing as land and shoot hunting. And now it seems as if wolf population regulation is going to be very similar to what we now call land and shoot hunting. So we're doing the same basic management practices that we've been opposed to for a long time, using airplanes for hunting and having the public do that, and we're just giving it a new name.
Like most of the planning team, Brown also was wondering how the zonal management system will break down. 6 zones have been proposed by the department. In Zone 1, no hunting or trapping of wolves or their prey would be allowed. Varying degrees of hunting would be allowed in other zones, all the way up to 6, where intense wolf management could be practiced. Brown says the management team wants those areas to be limited, but the zones won't be set until later. Since they don't know where those zones will be, they don't know how much of the state will be intensely managed. The Board of Game begins its meeting talking about wolves, but brown bears will also get some attention. The board will also consider defining subsistence users as those who obtain at least 50% of their food from wild fish and game and who spend at least 50% of their time hunting, fishing, gathering, and transporting wild fish and game. The meeting is scheduled to run through November 7th. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. In Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton. 3, 2, 1. She started on the Borough Assembly in 1980. Juanita Helms was elected mayor in 1985 and again in 1988. Many officials point to things they've done over the years, but for Helms, the best part of the job has been the people. She says the high point has been the people she's worked with and the people she's met. And she says her proudest accomplishment is the quality of the work that comes out of the borough now.
In accountability, in the kinds of audit reports that we get back from the auditor, the kind of product that we get from our public works department, and the lack of claims and lawsuits that we now have over our public works projects, I think reflects the quality of the work that gets done and the quality of the employees that we have. And that's a marked difference from 6 years ago. And I'm very proud of that.
Helms' accomplishments may not be remembered as much as her relationship with the Borough Assembly. 2 years ago, Helms told her department heads to quit going to assembly meetings because she didn't think they were being treated with respect. 3 months later, she sued the assembly for overstepping its legislative authority and trying to administer borough government. She says now she regrets settling that lawsuit out of court because she thinks she would have won. But at the time, attention was focused on the cost of one governmental branch suing another, not the big question of who was right and who was wrong. Nevertheless, Helms doesn't count all of that as a low point in her administration. She says she never fooled herself into thinking that she and the assembly would always get along. She says the problem wasn't disagreeing, but the method of disagreement. And she says things have improved in the last year, but her advice to her successor, Jim Sampson, is to not be intimidated.
I'm concerned that people think that there needs to be unity in everything. I don't think that's what government was designed to provide. It's supposed to be checks and balances. And the assembly represents fairly well the community. And our community, as everybody knows, is diverse, has conflicting opinions, and does not always get along with each other. But that's what an assembly is supposed to represent, and they do. And the fact that that makes for sometimes a messy meeting, sometimes some argument, I think is the way government is designed to run.
Helms attended her last borough assembly meeting last night. She and outgoing assembly members Bonnie Williams and Don Lowell were honored with resolutions. Newly elected assembly members Lane St. John and Cheryl Kilgore and the new mayor, Jim Sampson, were all sworn in last night. They start their duties Monday. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton.
I didn't write it just for the native people. I wrote it for every culture who's able to see it. So I didn't just write it for, a certain culture. I wrote it for every culture.
In Two Worlds means basically just that. We're dealing with understanding and communication throughout the play. Within the play, there's actually a scene called the translation scene, which is a non-native lawyer trying to communicate with an elder. It's a very funny scene, but it underscores what we're dealing with, what we had to deal with as natives, as a people of a whole within Alaska when the land claims did pass. So the time frame revolves around that. We've got other problems we deal with. My character is dealing with an alcohol problem, so we've got that in there. But what the problems people do have dealing with each other, cultural differences, that comes out within the play. But it also came out within the rehearsal process back home in trying to understand each other, five different native groups that we're dealing with within the play, trying to sift through all of that and understand what's going on. So we had this constant battle ourselves with communication and with understanding each other and trying to figure out what we really wanted.
Company on the Road. There once was a man named Jack Gabriel who spent every night of his life in the pub, never leaving until closing time, and sometimes not even then. He'd walk home late at night, barge into his house, knock over the furniture, wake up the whole family. Well, his loving wife had pleaded and begged, "Oh, Jack, come home early. Spend some time with your family." But, of course, he paid her no mind. Finally, in desperation, she scolded and screamed and nagged. "Well, at least you could come home quietly and not wake the rest of us up." But, of course, when he was drunk, he was incapable of that. You can imagine, relationships in that home were pretty strained when one winter's night, Jack left the pub as usual. Late, past closing. The moon was full. Beautiful moonlit night, and it shone on the road and reflected off the puddles, the ice on the puddles, for it's winter and cold. But for some reason this night, it wasn't a comforting light, but it was shifty and tricky. It was an altogether eerie night. To make matters worse, Jack's little dog that went everywhere with him began to whimper and bristle. Oh, Jack began to peer closely at the tree stumps in the hedges and the shadows under the trees, and he started to whistle and look frequently over his shoulder, and oh, he wished fervently for some company on the road. Well, he rounded a bend, and there to his surprise in the distance was a young woman. Oh, it looked like the fine figure of a young woman. She was wearing a poke bonnet and a shawl, and over one arm she had a basket that was covered. "Company for us," Jack said to his little dog. "Oh, and a fine young woman by the likes of her. I wonder what she's doing alone on a night like this. Oh, I expect she'll be glad of some company too, eh?" And in his haste to catch up with the young woman, Jack failed to notice that his little dog began to growl and slink backwards, and then he ran away altogether in the hedges. Jack caught up with the young woman and tipped his hat. "Good night to you, my dear, and a cold night it is." "Oh, yes. Oh, it is a cold night." When Jack heard her voice, he was delighted, for it was deep and soft and seductive. Oh, he was sure with a figure like hers and a voice like that, her face must be beautiful indeed. "Oh, and why are you out on such a cold night alone?" Oh, I had to go out. My grandmother is sick."
"Oh, and have you no father, nor brother, nor husband to walk out with you?"
Oh, no, sir. I'm all alone. I'm all alone in the world."
"Oh, and I'm that sorry for you, my dear. Here, let me take your basket."
And with that, Jack reached out and started to take her basket when he heard the voice say, "Oh, sir, you're so kind." But the voice, it came from the basket, not the bonnet. Jack turned to the young woman, and as if she knew what he was thinking, she turned to face him, and for the first time Jack saw beyond the brim of that bonnet, and he saw that it was quite empty.
"Oh, the headless Bogart!"
And in horror Jack dropped the basket, and as he did so the cloth fell off, and out of the basket rolled the beautiful head of a young woman, laughing as it rolled. Oh, Jack ran. He ran as he'd never run before, with his heart thumping and thudding inside his chest. Behind him he could hear the quick tap-tapping of the headless Bogart's feet,
and worse. Past him rolled that head and turned. And as it turned, it looked at him, and the whites of her eyes rolled up and the moonlight reflected off of him. The head rolled under his feet and sought to trip him up. But Jack jumped. As he jumped, the head leaped too, with the teeth gnashing at his heels. Jack ran. Jack ran as he had never run before. He ran until he thought his very heart would burst. All the time, behind him, he could hear the laughing of that head. As he reached home, he pounded and screamed for his wife to let him in. Which she did, and the little dog, too. Well, after that, Jack took to his bed for 3 long days. And for the rest of his life, he was never again late coming home. And his wife? What did his wife have to say about that night? Only this, that the headless Bogart must be a very clever little madam indeed, for she had been able to teach Jack to come home early and sober, which is something that she could not do, for all she had a head on her shoulders instead of in a basket.
Three, two, one. The tapestry is called Ancient Rhythms. Charlotte Van Zandt says it's her concept of seasonality. The long, narrow tapestry is alive with activity. It's not the images of man that attract your attention, though. It's the brightly colored fish and caribou spanning the piece.
I guess first let's start and say it's very colorful. It's meant to portray seasons, but not just the brief annual seasons either. It's long terms. It's long thousands upon thousands of years for me. There's a geological layer to it. There's the animals, and then there's the humans, and then there's the passage of time with these planetary bodies moving across it. Then there's the concept of solar winds, auroral winds, chinooks, these ribbons of color that are moving across this. The animals are moving across as if they're in a migratory pattern. The little humans are, it's a combination of being hunters and also being dancers. They're celebrating. They're celebrating life for me.
Van Zandt also wove a few handprints across the tapestry, denoting the constant attempt by humans to make their mark on things. She sketched her design onto a huge piece of paper the exact size of the tapestry, called a cartoon. Then she places the cartoon behind a huge frame, hand-built and threaded specifically for this project. She handpicks each thread through the giant harp-like frame by color, not line.
For this kind of weaving, it's almost better to do it all one by one by hand. It's very controlled, and you can achieve extremely intricate results. See, I'm not pattern weaving, so I don't need every thread all the way across coming up in sequences like you do when you're weaving yardage or things like that. I only need just the area that I'm weaving, because I weave only in the area I'm using right at the moment. This is much more like you'd see with Navajo rug weaving or things that are, I would call more of a, what you think of as a folk type weaving, something out of a little bit less machine-oriented culture. You don't have to have all that equipment to do intricate work.
Van Zandt buys as much of the material for the tapestry that she can locally. The $20,000 commission under the 1% for Art program covers her whole budget, from lumber for the frame to Alaskan wool that she hand dyes. Some of that yarn is also hand spun, so the texture is more fuzzy than smooth. Van Zandt says that's the fiber that gives the piece a lively surface texture.
I think of it as analogous to a painter who paints for the surface quality of the paint, being kind of rich and juicy paint built up on the canvas, and you know, where you see the brush strokes and things. I want to do that with fiber. I don't want it to be sloppy, but I want it to have that kind of richness that you see the stroke, the movement, the hand involved, rather than a piece that's so finely surfaced and finely finished that you really don't see that there was a human being behind it.
Other tapestries by Van Zandt hang in pioneers' homes in Ketchikan and Anchorage, correctional centers in Bethel and Fairbanks, and schools in Seward and the Matsu Valley. This tapestry is also a state commission, part of the 1% for Art program with the new University Park Elementary School. It was done with help from Michelle Ambrose, Shelley Swanson, and Nancy Hosley Johnson. In Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton. Three, two, one. Several ideas were proposed to raise more revenue for city coffers, but the old favorite, a sales tax, was the only one to survive a three-hour council meeting Monday night, and that proposal will go to voters only because council members backed off on an amendment that would have enacted the tax outright. Public testimony was not overwhelming, and it was divided. Some supported a sales tax, while others felt it wasn't the best answer to the city's budget problems. Most of the people testifying assumed that the issue would be voted on by the public. A few, like Dolores Clark, encouraged the council to take care of the matter itself.
You're put here by the public. The people vote for you to be put in here, and I think you should put the taxes through an ordinance, and I don't think the public should have to vote on it anymore. That's your job.
After the public hearing, Councilmember Bob Sundberg proposed amending the ordinance. Instead of sending the question to a special election, his amendment would have allowed the council to enact the tax. Council members Lowell Purcell, Mike Andrews, and Jim Hayes all voiced support for that idea, but Hayes questioned whether or not they weren't breaking some kind of trust with the people, since the plan all along was to have an election to decide the issue. That's when Sundberg withdrew his amendment.
There was a degree of trust imparted onto the citizens, you know, that they thought, we said, and the media said, it's going to go on the ballot. And then when some of those people have left the room tonight, knowing that they're going to have a chance to vote on it and speak to it in the future, that it's going to be a ballot issue, and Mr. Hayes reminded me of that, I felt it was wrong to go ahead and pass a taxing ordinance tonight, which people had been told was going to be on a ballot. That's why I withdrew the amendment.
Even though Sundberg proposed the amendment, he says he probably would not have voted for it. He did agree to put the question on the ballot, though, along with Purcell, Andrews, and Hayes. Two proposed changes to the city charter couldn't get past the council, so proposals to raise the property tax rate weren't even considered, since they hinged on one of those amendments. And there were a couple of other ideas that didn't get anywhere with the council. A $5 a day bed tax was withdrawn, a tobacco tax wasn't considered, and the council postponed asking voters to approve a motor vehicle registration tax. The council also postponed a plan to annex several businesses on the southwest side of town, including the new Fred Meyer store. Councilmember Jerry Cleworth was disappointed that the council didn't back some of his other proposals, so voters would have more of a choice in December. And he sees problems ahead.
The people who support a sales tax have several problems on which to overcome. One is that the city did not cap it. We did not put into the charter our intent to cap it. So that won't be on the ballot. So once the door is open, where it stops, I don't know. Two, we did not resolve the problem of the annexation of some of the major retailers in town. So we're going to set up a situation where some businesses are being hit with a sales tax and other ones are not. And if you're one of those businesses that's hit paying it, you pay the price with lower sales. It does hurt. So you've got some gaping holes in selling the public this sales tax the way it's configured right now.
A date for the special election still isn't official. It has been proposed for December 30th, but now can be held December 10th since charter amendments won't be on the ballot. What will be on the ballot for sure is a 1% sales tax with some exemptions. Officials estimate that could raise anywhere from $3 to $5 million for the city next year. The city budget, to be released later this week, will likely include cuts. The timing and results of an election on a sales tax may give city officials a better idea of what to prepare for in 1992. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. In Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton.